Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 15th of July. This hour of the program today, we're going to be talking about guns in Chicago in response to the U.S. Supreme Court decision saying Chicago's 38-year ban on handguns doesn't pass constitutional muster. This is how Chicago responded. To apply for a Chicago firearms permit, you must have a state firearm owner's identification card, two passport-sized photos taken in the last 30 days, and a valid driver's license or letter saying that you meet a vision requirement, a signed affidavit from a state-approved firearms instructor, and pay a $100 application fee. You must be 21 or at least 18 with a parent's permission, not convicted of a violent crime. You can't have two or more DUIs involving drugs or alcohol. You cannot have been convicted of domestic violence, misdemeanor, or felony convictions, both bar an applicant from getting a permit. Applicants have to be fingerprinted and subject to a background check, and the cost of registering a firearm is $15. You must file an annual report. Will this pass constitutional muster? It has already been challenged, and we will be talking with three different people with three different perspectives this hour of the program, starting with the chief Washington correspondent for the Washington Law Journal. We'll then be speaking with a spokesperson for the National Rifle Association, and later in the hour, the president of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and we begin our program with Marcia Coyle, who is the chief Washington correspondent for the Washington Law Journal. Hello, Marcia. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Marcia.
Thank you for having me.
So why is it that after 38 years, this was the year the Supreme Court said that the handgun ban is unconstitutional?
Well, actually, Kathleen, it took a little longer than that. 2 years ago, the Supreme Court faced the question of what actually does the Second Amendment really mean. Does it apply only to having guns in a militia, or does it protect an individual right to have a gun? And so 2 years ago, the court took up that question, which was actually the first time it had really looked at the content, the substance of the Second Amendment in almost 100 years. And it held that it protected an individual right to have a gun in the home for self-defense. What the court faced 2 years later, just this year, was whether that right was something that everybody outside of the District of Columbia had as well. Remember, the first challenge that came to the court 2 years ago involved a handgun ban in the District of Columbia, which is a federal enclave. It's not a state. And the Supreme Court had never looked at whether the Second Amendment should apply to the states. Just a little bit of history, Kathleen.
Sure.
You know, the Bill of Rights was initially drafted to protect us from actions by the federal government.
I see.
And so over a period of time, after the 14th Amendment was adopted, the court looked at whether those rights also should be protected from state action. And so this year, the Supreme Court looked again at the Second Amendment and decided that it does apply to the states as well as to the federal government when it comes to regulation of guns.
So then the question is, why did they let it sit the way it was for so many years? Why now? Is it the makeup of the Supreme Court or?
No, actually, they just had never taken a case. I know it sounds odd, but it just was, there was an old precedent, an old decision on the books from the late 1800s, and it just, the right case just never came along. When the D.C. gun ban was challenged, it just presented the right set of circumstances, and obviously, the federal government was concerned about what would happen when the federal appellate court in Washington, D.C. struck down the gun ban because there are federal gun laws. So the Supreme Court at that point decided, yeah, it was time to take a look at the Second Amendment. It seems strange, but most of the court's work in the last 100 years or so has really been with other parts of the Bill of Rights. There are still parts of amendments in the Bill of Rights that do not apply to the states. For example, grand jury indictments. States don't have to have grand juries indict people before they bring them to trial, but that is something that the federal government must do. So, you know, we tend to think that, you know, all of the Bill of Rights apply to the states, but there are still portions of them that don't. And the Second Amendment was the biggest portion that hadn't been decided, and finally the Supreme Court got into it.
Interesting. So how many communities are there in the United States, Marcia, that may have handgun bans, and would they be affected by this ruling? Are they now being affected?
Well, I think it's probably fair to say that just about every state constitution protects gun rights in some respect, and just about every major city and probably medium-sized cities also have some type of gun registration or gun regulation in effect. And the Supreme Court's decision this year applying the Second Amendment to the states is going to open up a large number of those regulations to challenge. In fact, I think the most certain thing we can say in the wake of the Supreme Court's decision is that there is going to be a huge amount of litigation over whether those regulations are going to pass constitutional muster.
Mm-hmm. So parts of what the Chicago City Council has now passed and the mayor is vehemently in favor of will be challenged. Are there certain parts of what I read at the beginning of the show that really raise a red flag immediately in your mind that you think the Supreme Court, and I guess I'm thinking of the ban of gun shops in the city of Chicago, they'll have to look at all of the aspects of their new firearm restrictions?
Absolutely. The one thing the Supreme Court left open, really, here, and this is going to put, you know, a lot of responsibility on judges throughout the country. The Supreme Court didn't say how judges should actually test these regulations under the Constitution. It didn't say what exactly, a state, a city, or a municipality has to show to justify that regulation. So it's a very uncertain landscape right now. It's my understanding that Chicago's latest gun-related regulation has parts of it that are okay in the minds of some and not so okay in the minds of others. But this was one of the concerns of the dissenters in the Supreme Court's decision this year, that the court really didn't give a whole lot of guidance as to how judges should look at this. Does the right to possess guns for self-defense, for example, does it extend outside the home, mm-hmm. to the car, to the workplace? And what sort of guns are necessary for self-defense? Handguns, rifles, you know, what exactly? Where can they really, or what time, what place can you hold that gun if it's not, you know, constrained to the home, for example? There are an awful lot of questions that are going to have to be worked out as these lawsuits are brought. And I have a very strong feeling that they're going to get back to the Supreme Court, probably not soon, but they will get there because the Supreme Court's going to have to clarify, you know, what is the rule here for judging gun regulation?
What about the states, Marcia, that allow people to carry guns pretty much anywhere? There are many states that allow you to have them outside and, you know, in your pocket, et cetera. What about the legal challenges to that? Haven't there been many of those, and why wouldn't the Supreme Court have taken that up?
I know there have been challenges to that, and a lot of those challenges were decided probably on the basis of state constitutions and what state legislatures had said, you know, when they approved the amendments to their state constitutions, and how the judges in those states interpreted how broadly the protection was under state constitutions. Those issues haven't gotten to the Supreme Court yet because they were based primarily on state constitutions. And the Supreme Court, you know, won't interfere with decisions made solely on the basis of state constitutions. It is primarily interested in how the federal constitution applies, the U.S. Constitution. There are just so many different types of gun regulations, and as I said, these decisions, recent decisions by the Supreme Court, you know, really do open up the landscape for litigation, and it's going to be expensive and it's going to be time-consuming, but the Supreme Court has said this is a fundamental right, and yes, the majority said there's going to be a lot of litigation, and yes, it's going to be expensive, but we're talking about a fundamental right, and when we have said other fundamental rights apply to the states have had to work it out, and it's just the cost, one of the costs of freedom and protection of our rights.
Don't you wonder why, and I wonder why, well, not know, I guess, or maybe there are documents that look at this, the framers of the Constitution didn't expand a little more on this right?
Boy, wouldn't it be nice
yes.
if they had really made a roadmap for us. But, you know, I think one of the beauties of our Constitution is that it's not always so specific. I mean, there are very specific portions of it, for example, you know, how old you have to be if you want to be a U.S. senator. But then there are general principles, and those principles are interpreted and applied as our lives change. So, it would be nice, but, you know, maybe if they had said something back in the 1700s very explicitly about the Second Amendment or other amendments, today we'd look at it and we'd say, huh? because the country has changed so much.
It sure has.
I agree with you there. But then the Supreme Court might be out of jobs.
Right. Let's take a couple calls for you. Marsha Cole, our guest, the first part of this program, will later speak with a spokesperson for the National Rifle Association and later for the president of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Bill in Milwaukee, hi.
Oh, hello. I'd like to make two major points, if I might. For one thing, there's an old phrase that there's nothing new under the sun in the area of firearms. There really isn't any kind of a modern firearm that didn't have a counterpart in the 18th century. And my favorite proof of that is that when Meriwether Lewis went on the Age of Discovery on that trip out west, this is 5 years after the Second Amendment was passed. He is a former military man, a private citizen, purchased at private sale a rifle imported from Austria that held 20 or 22 ready-to-fire charges in a tubular magazine, and he would demonstrate that before the Indians. He would fire those 20 or 22 shots accurately in less than 1 minute. That's the kind of firearm that was available to people who could purchase it in the 18th century, and nobody ever thought anything about it. The same is true when the Gatling gun was invented before the Civil War. You could purchase one of them. All you needed to have was the money. These modern gun control laws in America are based pretty much on the law that Adolf Hitler instituted in the 1930s, the Nazi Weapon Ban Act.
All right, let's get a response here. Marsha?
I think your caller is probably much more expert about the history of guns than I am. You know, my expertise is confined to what the Supreme Court has been saying all along. You know, if your listeners ever have a chance, they really ought to read these two decisions, and they're really easy to find on the Internet if you've got a computer, because they examine in detail, and it's fascinating, the history of the Second Amendment and the use of guns, and they go all the way back to our, you know, English roots. And at the end, you have two very different views of that history. It's why these two decisions ended in 5-4 votes. And when you read them, you know, you think, after you read one, you think, hey, you know, that sounds like it's right. And then you read the other, and you think, that sounds exactly like it's right. And in these two cases, there were many, many what we call friend of the court briefs filed by historians and other experts. And they also disagree on the history of the Second Amendment. Oof. So, you know, I can't speak specifically to guns and types of guns and the earlier versions of guns. But I can tell you that the history of this is, you know, reasonable minds can differ. And the people, the justices on the Supreme Court, are very, very smart. And I think these opinions were a really honest exploration of the history of the Second Amendment. And in the end, they disagreed.
They sure did. Marcia, thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. I enjoy being with you and hope to talk to you again. Take
Great.
Care.
Great. Thank you. Marcia Coyle, Chief Washington Correspondent for the Washington Law Journal. Alexis Fritz will be joining us, spokesperson for the National Rifle Association. We're talking about how Chicago responded to the U.S. Supreme Court decision saying that the ban on handguns in that city is unconstitutional. Chicago has responded with new rules in order to buy a gun in that city, and we're talking about whether or not, well, it's already been challenged. What do we need to determine about the Second Amendment? What exactly does it say? And will brilliant minds always disagree on this, and it's just something that we're going to have challenged for a long time? More phone calls, more guests coming up in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest now on the Ideas Network is Alexa Fritz, spokesperson for the National Rifle Association. Alexa, hello, and thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen. I'm glad to be here with you.
Let's look at what Chicago has done now as a result of the U.S. Supreme Court ruling. They have new rules now to buy a gun in Chicago, and those have been challenged already. What do you find problematic with their new rules?
Well, how much time do you have?
20 minutes.
It's hard to just pinpoint a few things because really we disagree with most of the extremely restrictive elements of this ordinance that the city has put into play. For one, it would prohibit all gun sales in the city. So that's a big problem right there. Where are people supposed to buy their guns? Why do they have to go outside of the city to exercise a constitutional freedom? Obviously, this is, you know, a fundamental inherent right, and people would be outraged if this kind of bureaucracy was applied to, let's say, freedom of speech or freedom of religion, you know. And I think that the Second Amendment is right up there with those other constitutional freedoms and should be treated equally. It also prohibits the possession of firearms outside the home, but when they say home, they're being very specific, and that would mean that even in your own garage or patio or backyard, you could not have a firearm. So if you're being attacked out there or a loved one is or someone's breaking into your home, you better not step out with your firearm or you could be the one in trouble, and it's just ridiculous. I could go on and on. There are so many different aspects of this which we completely disagree with. And the thing is, the bottom line is, there are already laws to address any and all crimes that can be committed with a firearm. So we don't need new laws and restrictions. We need to enforce the laws that we have and lock up criminals and leave the good guys, the law-abiding gun owners, alone and allow them the ability to actually practice this right.
The mayor, Mayor Daley of Chicago, said that we already have enough gun shops all over the metropolitan area. I'm sorry. It is something that we think is necessary that we take a stand. Now they can challenge it. Fine.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, he's just going to make this as burdensome and tough to actually put into play as possible. And that's not a surprise. We didn't think that he'd just roll over and say, okay, you know, the Second Amendment wins, I lose. So for that very reason, this is a debate that's going to continue, and the lawsuits and court challenges will continue until we can actually get this resolved. You know, this is a great victory, this McDonald case, but if it's only a victory on paper, if it's only a legal victory, then we're not satisfied. We want this to be a practical, substantive victory, and we won't be happy until all law-abiding Americans have that ability to actually own a firearm, buy a firearm, you know, in a place that's convenient to them, and practice their Second Amendment rights.
What about some restrictions? I really think most Americans would agree with this. Maybe I'm wrong, that you can't have had been convicted of a violent crime, have two or more driving under the influence involving drugs or alcohol, can't have been convicted of domestic violence, misdemeanor or felony convictions, both bar an applicant from getting a permit. Is that too restrictive?
I mean, I don't want to speak for the NRA on each and every one of those counts, but I can tell you that obviously the NRA, like most of America, thinks that there are certain people, certain prohibited parties that, yeah, should not be anywhere near a firearm. And that does include felons. That would include anyone also who has been adjudicated as mentally defective, and that's legal terminology, not our terminology. But, yeah, there are certain people that don't have any business being near a firearm. But we're talking about the law-abiding people. We want to talk about your average American who, you know, has not been convicted of a felony, who's not a drug dealer, who, you know, just wants the chance to defend their loved ones, themselves, and their property when they're at home.
Obviously, one of the reasons that the city council in Chicago and the mayor wanted this ban and have for a long time is because of the violence in the city. And much of the violence is handguns are used in that violence. As you know, the murder rate in Chicago has been very high
Yes.
in the past year. What's a way to deal with that without getting rid of handguns?
Well, I mean, the simple fact is if gun control and gun bans actually worked, Chicago would be one of the safest cities in the U.S., and instead, as we know, it's a city that's got one of the highest crime rates because criminals don't follow the law. So, you know, the more gun laws they try to tack on, criminals just look at those and laugh, and they're the ones right now that are running that city. And that's why, I mean, you see that gun bans actually don't work. I think that what we will actually definitely see if people are actually able to exercise their Second Amendment freedoms is that crime will drastically go down in Chicago, because right now criminals know that they're the only ones armed, so they can feel free to go commit crimes, and you know they know that their victim is not going to be armed. But things are going to change there once people can actually put into play their Second Amendment freedoms. But as far as addressing the crime, it just comes down to stricter enforcement of the current gun laws. And I feel awful for Chicago. I worry about the people in that city. I have loved ones that live in Chicago. I'll be actually visiting there soon myself. And it's scary. It's scary that crime is that bad, but unfortunately it just shows that a gun ban is completely ineffective.
Let's welcome some phone calls for you. Our number is 800-486-8655. And our guest this part of the program is Alexa Fritz, a spokesperson for the National Rifle Association. We're looking at various sides of McDonald versus the City of Chicago, the recent Supreme Court case that overturned Chicago's ban on handguns. Jeremy from Minocqua is our next caller. Hi, Jeremy.
Hello.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
Good, good. Good. First of all, I just wanted to say that I totally agree with the statement earlier made about less restrictions are at least maintaining the ones that we have currently. You know, criminals out there don't abide by the rules. So, you know, the restrictions really only affect the law-abiding citizens that, you know, try to go out and purchase firearms legally. But mainly I called because the interpretation of the Second Amendment as it was written back then, the purpose why it was put in place was to prevent, because we had just become a free nation after the war. So the purpose for them putting that in the Constitution was to protect the citizens from tyranny from the government itself. So it's not just about the homeowner trying to protect his home and his family from outside criminals locally, but also from the government itself. I mean, we don't really think that that could possibly ever happen again like it did then, but I honestly think it could. I mean, if we went through and took all the firearms away from every citizen in the United States and the government decided one day to start infringing on everyone's constitutional rights and coming into homes and doing things that weren't constitutional, there would be nothing for us to fight back with. We would be farmers with hoes and garden sticks. I mean, it would be ridiculous.
Alexa.
Yeah, well, the militia aspect, you know, is brought up quite a bit. I think there are a lot of interpretations to the Second Amendment, and I think there are a lot of interpretations to what self-defense means. You know, but he's right. That is the, you know, partially the original intent of the Second Amendment. We had just overthrown the British and taken this country and made it our own. So those were those times, and you know, times are different now. Thankfully, we hopefully do not have to worry about the government doing that. But actually, I'll actually point to post-Katrina in New Orleans, the government did come around and say, give me your firearms. Because, you know, there was rioting going on. It was a scary time in New Orleans. And unfortunately, though, when people were scared and were trying to defend their property and themselves from a lot of the criminal activity that was going on, the firearms were being confiscated by lawmakers there. So actually, the NRA has put into place something called emergency powers legislation. We've pushed to have that legislation enacted in several states now to prevent something like that from happening.
Do you think our last guest from the Washington Law Journal said it was interesting to her to look at the details of this decision that you can have, let's say, 12 people, all brilliant minds. Six of them will say that there was constitutional reason to uphold a ban. Six of them would say that there was constitutional reason to not uphold the ban. And I'm wondering if you think, because we have this debate that's been going on in this country for a long, long time, Alexa, if we simply don't know what the original intent was, and it may have been one of those amendments that was just written without a whole lot of explanation, and as a result, we've been struggling with it, particularly recently.
I think there's plenty of writings and plenty of things to reference from our founding fathers that show they absolutely think that the Second Amendment is something that Americans should be able to freely use to defend themselves in any way that, you know, legally they are allowed to do so. And I think that the Second Amendment is there in our Constitution for a reason. If it was that important for our founding fathers to put into the Constitution, then I think that any Supreme Court and any judge out there should recognize that it's an important right that needs to be upheld.
Rachel calling from Chicago. Hi, Rachel.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question for your guest.
Hi, Rachel. Go ahead.
Hi. when I am from Chicago, and I'm wondering if when you come to visit, are you going to go to the Southwest Side where all the kids are killing each other with the guns? And if so, you have a gun, and will that make you feel safer to hang out on the Southwest Side of Chicago?
I don't know what our plans include yet, but no, I wouldn't feel safe in that city as it is right now, not a bit. And I feel bad for you that it is an unsafe city, that there are parts of that city that are, you know, where people are being shot. It's a travesty. Nobody likes that. Nobody thinks there's anything good about that. But that's not resulting from people being able to exercise their Second Amendment right. That's resulting from criminals running rampant in that city unchecked and the law-abiding people having to just take it.
Thanks for your call, Rachel. Mark in Hudson. Hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I do agree with Second Amendment rights. I'm wondering if your guest could speak to the idea that the more that we arm the public, the more it'll be a deterrent for violent criminals or criminals using guns. Because it seems to me that, let's say, professionals that would have a gun, say police officer or military, would have hundreds of hours with that firearm. Learning muzzle control, how to designate between shoot and no-shoot targets. So they're very familiar and good with that firearm. And I'm wondering, if we did allow more liberal firearm control, should we have some sort of certification for those people that would own a firearm? And I'll take my response off the air.
All right. Thank you very much, Mark.
Oh, okay. Do you want me to address that, or am
Please.
I supposed to address that off the air?
No, on the air.
Okay. Well, we certainly at the NRA encourage training with firearms. In fact, we offer training in all states for firearms owners, and it's something that we take very seriously, and we definitely encourage people to get training. And most states do require some kind of training, but some don't. So it's really your responsibility as a gun owner to know what you're doing with that gun. And most people that would bother to go out and buy a firearm are the kind of person who enjoys going and getting that training, enjoys going to the shooting range and being very comfortable with that firearm. And so that's definitely something that we encourage.
The Chicago, the new ordinance would be that you would have to do training, that it would be 4 hours in the classroom and 1 hour on a firing range. Is that too restrictive?
Well, what I can say about that is that it would actually be impossible for people to get that training because it would be unlawful to operate a shooting range inside the city limits according to that very same ordinance. So I think they have a lot of things to still work out in their laws that they're trying to enact there. But again, you know, we definitely encourage people to get some sort of training. I don't know that necessarily needs to be forced upon someone because people are going to go out and do that anyway. It's that important, and most of your law-abiding gun owners know that, and so they do that on their own. It doesn't really have to be forced upon them.
So you wouldn't believe that requiring such firearms training would be constitutional?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's a bad idea to get training, but I don't know that there needs to be a law forcing somebody to go do that.
Okay. Thanks very much for the call, and thank you so much for being with us, Alexa.
I enjoyed it. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Alexa Fritz, our guest this part of the show, spokesperson for the National Rifle Association. Paul Helmke will be joining us momentarily, president of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. We are looking, there will be a lot of challenges. They're already surfacing to the Chicago rules to buy a handgun in Chicago, which many feel are still way too restrictive. This after the U.S. Supreme Court last week decided that the ban on handguns in the city of Chicago was unconstitutional. Our phone number, your calls are still applicable. We're just hearing different viewpoints here. So our phone number is 800-486-8655. And you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this part of the program is Paul Helmke, president of the Brady Campaign and the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence. Prior to this, he was a lawyer in Fort Wayne, Indiana, served as mayor from 1988 to the year 2000, and he was the Republican nominee for the United States Senate in Indiana in the year 1998. Our phone number remaining the same, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Hello, Paul. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me on.
If we have such wildly different and some would say extremely well thought out and intellectually exhaustive understanding of the Second Amendment, and yet we come up with wildly different ideas of what's constitutional and what's not constitutional, how are we ever going to decide what kind of gun rights ownership should exist around the country?
Well, I think in a way things are really a lot easier now that the courts had their decisions over the last 2 years in both the Heller case and the McDonald case. The court, in effect, said that the extremes are off the table. They said that the idea of a nearly complete gun ban is unconstitutional, and that's why they ruled that it's an individual right, ruled that you've got a right to have a gun in the home, handgun in the home for self-defense. But at the same time, the court said the other extreme, this idea that there are no limits and that anybody can have any gun anywhere, any place, anytime, they said that's off the table, too. That really should help the discussion. It puts the whole argument in the middle. The idea that, we can't try gun control because they're going to take all of our guns away and only criminals will have guns, unconstitutional, not going to happen. But this idea that you can't have any limits, also off the table. Now we can argue about, hey, we've got some restrictions on machine guns and fully automatics now. That's been around since about 1934. Maybe we should, is that line at the appropriate place? Should we redraw the line to reflect 50 caliber sniper rifles and semi-automatic military-style assault weapons? We've said since 1968 that felons and people who are dangerously mentally ill shouldn't have guns. Does that properly reflect folks who we sense are dangerous? We say that some places are sensitive places and shouldn't allow guns, like courts and like our capitals and legislative bodies. Are there, what other places should be there? Those are the sorts of areas of discussion that we should be focused on. I think actually if we focused on that, we and people from the gun rights side, from the NRA, were willing to sit down and talk openly, we could reach agreements on these things.
So eventually it's the U.S. Supreme Court that will have to decide what the limits are and what kind of policy we're going to have, because what they decided is fairly vague,
right?
And so it's being interpreted in all kinds of ways.
Well, it is still fairly vague. Part of it is getting politicians particularly to focus on what the court actually said. I think a lot of people respond to these court rulings without ever reading the court rulings. And in the Heller case particularly, the court went out of its way to say, Justice Scalia went out of his way as the author of the majority decision, to say that the right is not unlimited and that you can restrict who gets guns, where they take guns, how guns are sold, how guns are carried, how guns are stored, and even what kind of guns they are.
Mm-hmm.
Now, where you draw the line is going to be a little bit messy, but I sat through the court arguments in both the Heller case and the McDonald case, and one of the points that was made during the argument is that, First Amendment law was messy, too. In 1964, the court said in the New York Times versus Sullivan case, they defined libel as it applied to public officials and public figures, but they had a series of cases for years after that said, where do you draw that line exactly? Similarly on pornography, which is another First Amendment issue. The court had a decision in the early 70s defining, saying that it's not obscene if it if community standard, or it's obscene if it doesn't fit community standards. But then they had to go through another series of court tests to figure out exactly where you drew the line. Once those lines get drawn, most legislative bodies don't step over it in terms of pornography or in terms of libel law. And I think we're going to have something similar with Second Amendment law. The thing that we still need from the court, and really that I think would help this, is if they would indicate what the standard of review for these decisions should be. We've argued that outside of saying that gun bans are and total gun bans are unconstitutional, that you should give great deference to to the decisions of elected officials, and that you should have a reasonableness standard. As long as the legislative bodies had some rational basis for it, that should be good enough.
Mm-hmm. And yet, you also look at what the decision is here, that you could have a Supreme Court, and some of it is just, maybe it's a political ideology on the part of people, but you got 5-4 decisions mm-hmm. happening fairly regularly here. Mm-hmm. You could have 5-4 going another direction a few years from now. So in some ways, it's what people are thinking who are on the court, right? And
right.
maybe not entirely, because the Constitution is so vague on this.
Right, but it's the way the court works. I mean, I read a lot of blog comments. Oh, it was only a 5-4 decision. Our you know, who knows what will happen if there's another justice that fills the slot. You know, first of all, the justices that have gone off. I mean, Sotomayor replaced Souter, Kagan, you know, likely to replace Stevens. That's not going to change the mix in the court. And generally, even though it's a 5-4 vote, generally the court keeps those things in place for a long time. The Miller case that in 1939 that said that the Second Amendment dealt with the militia, you know, that was in effect for a good 70 years till they came up with a new definition saying it's an individual right. The you know, Roe versus Wade has certainly been controversial, but that really hasn't changed since 1973, even with a lot of justices changing. Justices generally do follow settled law, do give some credence to precedent. They do make changes occasionally, but it's usually only after a long passage of time.
Let's go to some phone calls for you, starting with Paul in La Crosse. Hi, Paul.
Hi, good morning. Yes, I was wondering, if you're carrying a lawful firearm under the new rules that we have, are you protected from civil liability? I recall a few years ago there was a shootout between off-duty policemen whose car was being carjacked. They came out of the gunfight okay, but a bystander was killed. I was wondering, do people in situations like that have any recourse in court, or is it that's too bad?
Yeah, that's civil liability for basically mistakes made in using guns is usually still going to be up to state law. States have written different levels of protection, different levels of liability, and most of those have generally been upheld by the courts in the past. These Supreme Court decisions probably aren't going to change a whole lot of existing laws. It's a lot of states have Second Amendment equivalents that are actually more tightly written, stronger for gun rights than the federal Constitution has. But even under those, courts have generally upheld different levels of liability, different bans on types of specific weapons, different procedures with regard to selling and who can buy and how much you can buy. So that's pretty much going to be a state-by-state issue as to what the liability is going to be in one of those situations.
Nate is next from Milwaukee. Hi, Nate.
Hi, thanks for having me. And mm-hmm. I was just going to make a couple points. One is that if the theory is having guns scares away criminals, you would think that a concealed carry state would have a much lower crime rate than a non-one. Yet if you look at, say, South Carolina and compare it to Wisconsin, Wisconsin does not have concealed carry, but it does have a much lower murder rate. And the same goes if you compare Wisconsin and, say, Texas, even before the pseudo-civil war started up in Mexico. So criminals still commit crimes in states where people are encouraged to carry around weapons. A different point that had been raised earlier was the idea of tyranny, and I'd like to point out that in Iraq under Saddam, people actually had plenty of gun rights, and it did not stop him from being a tyrant at all. So there are a couple theories bouncing around out there. So one point to your current current guest is that judges are appointed by presidents all the time, and there is a strong argument that their views can definitely switch some of the decisions made because they may have a certain agreement with whatever president that appoints them on a given topic.
Paul.
Yeah, it's with regard to the first point, I engage in a lot of debates on this this theory that you know, more guns means less crime. And you know, my response is, if more guns made us safer, we'd be the safest country in the world, and we're not. And generally, the research that I've looked at says that if you've got a gun in your home, you're more likely to have that gun used against you or a family member than to protect you. Actually, one study says 21 times more likely to be used against you or a family member than to protect you. More guns in a home means more gun violence in that home. More guns in a city means the same. More guns in a state means the same. More guns in a country means the same. You know, the issue really is... yes, there are some gun rights as decided by the court, but there are responsibilities and risks that go with gun ownership. And right now, we don't have enough focus on that. We just make it too easy for dangerous people to get guns, and too easy for folks who don't recognize the responsibilities and risks of gun ownership to have them.
Did the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence have a statement about the recent Supreme Court decision?
Yes. We actually had filed a brief in the case, and it was technically a neutral brief. We felt that it was going to be tough for Chicago to justify its ordinance, given the fact that D.C. had lost on theirs, and given the way that the court had considered the Second Amendment in the Heller case. We disagreed with the Heller ruling. We felt they got the history of the Second Amendment wrong, but once the Heller case was decided, that became the law. So we filed a neutral brief in the McDonald case, encouraging the court to both set a standard of review, which they didn't do, but also to restate the restrictions that Justice Scalia talked about in Heller, and the court did that. So our statement post McDonald was that that the ruling really was not a surprise. Because of the Heller case, that it was really a narrow ruling. It only affected really Chicago and the one suburb, because those are the only communities that still had complete handgun bans. And it was really a very narrow definition of the Second Amendment. It was a definition that said you've got a right to have a gun in your home for self-defense. And with the fact that they stressed the restrictions, we felt that it really should allow, hopefully, our political discourse to go forward and try to figure out, instead of arguing about how many... about what the framers intended with the Second Amendment, let's figure out what we can do, given this definition of the Second Amendment, to make our community safer. And I think that means reasonable gun laws.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Nate. Dave in Madison. Hi. Dave, are you there?
Dave, yes. My position on this has always been that the argument that guns are can be used for defensive purposes is just foolhardy. I think they're primarily an offensive weapon, and an example I use is when President Reagan was shot back in 81, this kid with a .22 pistol managed to knock down the president, Jim Brady, and another cop, and there were firearms all around to protect the president, and they didn't do one damn bit of good. In the end, all they could do is wrestle this kid down and get the gun away from him. You know, my other position on that is the idea that we have to have handguns to protect ourselves. I grew up as a hunter, and I know the inaccuracy of a handgun in terms of protection. I think if we want to protect our families, if I felt it was necessary, what I would have is a shotgun with birdshot in it, where I wouldn't have to be a very good shot to knock somebody down. The idea that the handgun is going to protect us is just totally absurd. That's my position. I'll take
all
the
right,
response
Dave.
Off the air. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent points. And I use the same example of the shooting of President Reagan, Jim Brady, 29, almost 30 years ago now, is another example where more guns doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be protected. And the real lesson from that was that John Hinckley, the shooter, was somebody who had a documented history of mental problems, but because we didn't do background checks at that time, he was able to buy a gun in Texas and travel to D.C. and then get through the Secret Service police protection and cause great damage and almost fatal damage to our president, and great damage to Jim Brady and the others around him. So that's an excellent point. And the other thing about the shotgun, interesting point, and it's a lot of people haven't pointed this out. In the Chicago case, the plaintiff, Otis McDonald, actually has a shotgun in his home. He was allowed under Chicago law to have a shotgun. Every police officer I've talked to says that the shotgun's a better self-defense self-defensive weapon than a handgun. You don't have to be as accurate. It looks scarier. It sounds scarier, and it's more effective. But in effect, the McDonald case was the Supreme Court second guessing the Chicago local officials on whether it was better to have a shotgun or a handgun in the home. And that shows what goes wrong when you have the courts trying to rewrite these laws.
But, right.
Good point.
Yeah, thanks for the call. Paul, thank you for your time today.
Appreciate
your being with
us.
Thank you. Paul Helmke, our guest this last part of the program, president of the Brady Campaign and the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence. He was president of the United States Conference of Mayors in 97-98 and also Republican nominee for the U.S. Senate in Indiana in 1998. Earlier guests, Paul was just with us, Alexa Fritz, spokesperson for the National Rifle Association, and to give us an idea of what the Supreme Court was actually saying with this Chicago decision, Marcia Coyle, chief Washington correspondent for the Washington Law Journal. Thanks to Chrissy Pease and Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We'll have news coming up in just a moment from NPR, and then we'll return with more Thursday conversation that will be interesting. So stay with us. This is the Ideas Network.